Current State on WKAR, Monday, March 3rd, 2014. I'm Joe Lindstroth in for Mark Bayshore. One last day, Mark is back tomorrow. I'm sure there are many of you out there on this Monday morning, bleary-eyed from staying up late last night, hanging on the edge of your couch, wondering what Putin was going to do in Crimea. No doubt. That is why everyone is tired this morning, standing by the water cooler today, discussing the daring fashion of the soldiers without insignias and masks and all that kind of stuff on a Monday here. After the Academy Awards, we have a great show for you today. Coming up later in the hour, we'll look at a documentary that features Lansing's pride, Elderly Instruments. Documentary came out a couple years ago, is now on DVD. We'll take a look back at that. Also, Anna Howard Shaw is a prominent Michigan woman you may not have heard of whose work in the women's suffrage movement really made a difference. And we'll also be talking with Sparrow Health System and Volunteers of America Michigan about the opening of a brand new clinic today, exclusively for the Capital Region's homeless population. Very exciting day today for Lansing Social Services. But first, last Friday, the state released the results of the Michigan Education Assessment Program, better known as the MEAP. The statewide tests were administered to Michigan residents in grades 3 through 9 last fall for the final time, as the state will move to an online assessment, which is likely to be more aligned with the Common Core standards, in the spring of 2015. With me now by phone to assess the results of the final MEAP test is Sarah Lenhoff. She's the Director of Policy and Research for the Education Trust Midwest, which is a statewide nonpartisan research organization based in Royal Oak. Welcome to Current State, Sarah.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me.
First, give us the good news. Where do we see some improvements?
So we see a little bit of improvement in reading in 4th grade, 5th grade, and 6th grade. And that's where, it's not much improvement, but a little bit. Overall, the results, though, released on Friday are not good. We see.
So we're going to jump right to the bad news.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, not a lot. So there were some gains in science and writing, though, a little bit worth noting.
Yeah, that's right. So in science, we saw sort of the biggest gains, almost 4 points in 5th grade and 8th grade. And then in writing in 4th grade, we saw almost a 4-point gain as well.
Okay. All right, now on to the not-so-good news. What numbers jumped out at you?
So for us, we really look at 4th grade reading as a barometer of how students are doing in elementary school, because reading is in 4th grade, you start reading for other subjects like science and social studies. So we look to that to see how students are doing. And according to data released on Friday, about 70% of students in 4th grade reading are proficient. In 8th grade math, which is a good barometer of how students might do in high school, only about 35% of 8th graders were proficient in math, so we're really concerned about that.
How does this break down? Can you break this down according to race and income levels? I mean, what are you seeing in terms of African-American students, the discrepancy between African-American and white students and lower-income students versus higher-income students?
Right, that's right. So Michigan has long had pretty large achievement gaps in its subgroups. So in African-American students and low-income students in particular, they perform much worse than their white counterparts or higher-income counterparts. So, for instance, fewer than 50% of African-American fourth graders were proficient in reading. And according to our national assessment results, we are actually one of the worst performing states for African-American students. So that's a big concern to us. There are also huge gaps between low-income student performance and higher-income student performance. So, for instance, in public schools in Ann Arbor and in Grosse Pointe, as just two examples, there's actually a 40 percentage point gap between the performance of low-income kids and higher-income kids in 8th grade math.
In the same school district.
Right, in the same school district.
You'd mentioned the national assessments, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, or NAEP. You know, comparing that, I mean, how accurate of a reading, in your view, are we getting with these MEAP results?
Yeah, I think so. The state did some work a couple years ago to better align with our national assessment, which is really considered the most rigorous and kind of comprehensive assessment we have in the nation. They did a pretty good job in math, but I will say not a great job in reading. So according to the national assessment, only about 31% of our fourth graders are proficient in reading, which is a 40 percentage point difference between what the state is saying and what the national assessment is saying. And we really are looking to the national assessment as being a good indicator of what our results will look like next year when we adopt new assessments aligned to our higher career and college ready standards.
So am I hearing you're expecting maybe a slight rude awakening as we shift to these new standards next year?
I think so, yeah, particularly in reading. We've adopted much more rigorous standards. We're getting new assessments that are actually going to give us much more robust and detailed information on student performance, but I think they will kind of reveal that we've been telling ourselves that we're doing a little bit better than we actually are.
What's the reason or reasons for this discrepancy? Why is the MEEP not aligned with the National Assessment for Educational Progress?
Well, it's based on our previous academic standards, which were really aligned to what students needed to do in sort of an industrial economy. And, you know, since then, we're in the 21st century, where we've moved on to really a knowledge-based economy, 21st century workplace. And so our new standards have improved and risen because of the demands on students and what they'll really be required to do in college and when they're competing with their peers in the country and around the world.
Have you, you know, the EAA has been discussed quite a bit lately, just even the last couple of weeks, but over the last couple of years, that is the state's emergency school district for some of the worst performing schools in the state right now, just in Detroit. Have you had a chance to review the EAA's MEEP scores?
I did take a look at their percentage proficient change from last school year to this school year. This is really the first year that we can look at those data and attribute any sort of achievement to the EAA. And there were some improvements and some declines. You know, it varied depending on the school. I will say, though, it's really early to be kind of attributing any real results to the actual EAA, right? School turnaround is complex. It takes time. National research suggests it takes about 3 years to really see a significant bump in student learning due to, you know, school improvement efforts. So I would say, you know, caution anyone to really, you know, put too much weight in the results that came out on Friday, according to the EAA.
Either way on that.
Either right. way, right, right.
What's the Education Trust stance on the EAA in general?
You know, we think that we are encouraged by anyone who is really putting a strong effort in school improvement. We're kind of waiting to see about the results in the coming years. We're excited about potential improvements and a chance to sort of see innovation in the school improvement sphere, but and we want to make sure that those schools are held accountable. We have worked to make sure that they're continuing to take part in the state assessments and the state accountability system so we can monitor their progress. So we're watching closely and hopeful.
Mm-hmm. In your point of view, is there enough current data now on the EAA to justify a large expansion of the program as being discussed in the legislature and supported by the governor?
I'm not sure, honestly. I can't really speak to that.
Okay. So, you had talked about, now this is the last year for the state that will be using the MEEP tests. It's likely transitioning next year to the Smarter Balance Assessment,
right.
Which is part of the new Common Core, although the legislature still has to make that final decision. Yeah, how will these new tests work?
So these new tests, if we do move forward with Smarter Balance, which we think is the right path forward for Michigan, will be computer adaptive. So they'll be given on a computer, and they will adapt to whether a student gets a question right or wrong. The difficulty of the next questions will change based on that. And it's the way the GRE is done, for instance. And it's a really good way to get very accurate information on where a student is in the trajectory and according to the standards. So instead of sort of a fixed form test, these assessments will give us sort of very nuanced information that teachers can use to then inform their instruction. Most teachers and parents say the MEEP today is not very helpful in doing that, so we're really hopeful about the new assessments and their ability to really key in on where students need the most help.
And these are computer-based. Are there provisions in place if a school is not equipped to handle that, you know, with Wi-Fi capabilities or enough computers, et cetera, to take that test?
Yeah, so there are plans to make sure that districts and schools that don't have the capability to use computers can use a paper and pencil option.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as some of the other, but you mentioned, you know, we get more real-time or sooner results that can be implemented. You know, what are some of the other benefits that you see coming out of this shift?
Well, I think the biggest benefit is that it's going to be aligned to what we know kids really need to know and be able to do, and therefore give us a more honest portrait of how Michigan students are doing and therefore where we need to maybe make large-scale changes in our kind of instructional models and our ways of addressing student weaknesses. And then also, as I was saying, on sort of individual student levels, how can we better address both student strengths and weaknesses? I think we're going to get much better data on all of those fronts.
Now, the legislature is considering or looking at, there are a number of tests out there, but the Education Department has recommended the Smarter Balance test. Is that where you stand as well with the Education Trust? Are there other tests you're looking at as well, or do you support the Smarter Balance test moving forward?
I think right now, and for next school year, the Smarter Balanced assessment, in our view, is the best option for Michigan. It not only will give us the kind of data and information we need, but it's also kind of ready to go. It's the only assessment that we know of that Michigan has said we are ready to implement it next school year, and we think that's hugely important. We need to move on past the MEEP and adopt these new standards and align our assessments to those standards. There needs to be alignment throughout that system.
Sarah Lenhoff is the Director of Policy and Research for the Education Trust Midwest. Thank you, Sarah, for joining me to talk about the MEEP results.
Thanks, Joe.
This is our first show of March, which is Women's History Month. Current State Scott Pohl is here with a look at a new book about a Michigan woman and her role in America's suffrage movement. Scott?
Hi, Joe. I'm good. How are you?
I'm well.
This is the story of Anna Howard Shaw. She was born in England in 1847, and her family moved to America. She grew up in Michigan. After an isolated farm upbringing, Shaw enrolled at Albion College, which became a springboard to a life as a minister, in medical studies, in Boston, and ultimately to work in the reform movements of that era. Shaw served as vice president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association in the 1890s and was the association's president from 1904 to 1915. Albion College professor Tricia Franzen has written a biography of this remarkable woman. It's called Anna Howard Shaw, The Work of Woman Suffrage. Franzen says Shaw's career trajectory was unusual for her day.
It was, and I think the thing that was even more unusual was that, you know, she was self-supporting this whole time. She had been contributing to her family's support from the time she was 12 because her father was a sort of intellectual dreamer who never quite got the hang of farming. And so she had to pick it up. She also was the one who supported the family while the men went off to fight in the Civil War. But she found that she was being called, or she felt she was being called. And as many of the women who went into the ministry very early, they felt that, you know, God was calling them and they didn't need to pay attention to mere mortal men. So that was sort of her way of leaving, whether it was some balance between the actual vocational call and a real serious ambition.
What might have sparked her interest and her fervor in the suffrage movement, though? Was there anything in particular that might have set her on that path?
I think that her entire experience as a woman, as a girl even, that she saw, you know, how unfair things were, and maybe even more was the experience of her mother, because her mother was a woman who had to pick up the pieces when her father, who was this sort of dreamer, made very impractical plans. So, you know, the father had gone into business in England. It had gone bankrupt. He decided then that they had to pay off the debts and then they were going to come to the United States. Well, you know, he left for the United States and left the family there. And she was the one who was working as a seamstress, raising these seven children for over a year before they could all get enough money to come to the U.S. And she saw, again, you know, her mother struggling when they moved to Michigan. And that's a pretty interesting story in itself about how the father and several of the older brothers stayed back in Massachusetts, and the women of the family and one young son came to Michigan, and they had to manage somehow.
Did she ever marry herself or have children?
Well, I argue that Shaw was way ahead of her time on many points, and one of them would be developing, for lack of a better term, an alternative family. She ended up partnering with Susan B. Anthony's niece, Lucy Anthony. Lucy was also essentially her business manager, and they lived together for over 30 years. During that time, and earlier even, Shaw had wanted to adopt children. She had tried to adopt when she was in medical school. She had also stepped in when her older sister died and left three young children. But what she ended up doing was she ended up really being part of an extended Anthony Shaw family that included nieces and nephews on both, you know, family sides. And so when she died, for example, she left certain bequests to her nieces. And then when Lucy died, because, of course, Anna had left most of her estate to Lucy. Lucy left bequests to both Anthony and Shaw nieces.
Anna Howard Shaw isn't well known. Those who have maybe heard of her think of her as Susan B. Anthony's protege or second banana, maybe. First of all, is that so from your perspective? And is it fair to think of her that way?
One of the reasons I wrote this book was because I so disagree with the way most historians have portrayed Shaw. And one of the problems that I faced was figuring out why Shaw had greater cultural currency before sort of the rise, you know, the last 40, almost 50 years of women's history than since. I have a lot of theories about that. But I think that what we really need to look at is what Shaw did and how Shaw did pick up where Anthony left off, but took the suffrage movement really into the mainstream. That period from like 1904 to 1910 was a struggle. There wasn't much happening. It felt like things were the doldrums. I think the doldrums really were around 1900 to 1904. By 1910, I think they had reached the turning point. And that it just kept going from there. And part of that was because of Shaw and the fact that Shaw was, in some ways, far more a typical U.S. citizen than many of the other suffrage leaders. She came from, you know, a farming background. She had struggled. She had seen what most people did. She traveled constantly. She was constantly in touch with people. She knew what was going on in people's lives. She knew how to reach people. She was the orator of the movement.
I was going to bring up her skills as an orator, in a lot of ways, the public face of the movement, with countless, maybe an exaggeration, hundreds, perhaps thousands of public speeches on behalf of the suffrage movement.
One scholar said that Shaw produced 15,000 speeches in the course of her 30 years. And I've fooled with these numbers because, like, I have her diary. I know where she talked and I would say about 100 different places a year. But how many speeches she made, how many people she actually reached, it was large because then there was also the newspaper coverage whenever she spoke. Sometimes it was even international coverage. but she really was the face. And I think the other thing that I always want to mention is that Shaw was funny. She had a tremendous humor. She had a very different delivery than most of the other women speakers, particularly of that generation. And I think that this made her both entertainment as well as education when she spoke.
You've mentioned having access to her diary. What other source materials did you have to learn about her?
Well, there were certain documents that she held on to. Well, it was very fun to see her certification as a teacher in Mecosta County from the 1870s. So we had documents from some documents from her early years. Of course, we had her autobiography. We had two biographies, one which was a dissertation Ralph Spencer wrote in 1970. There was also a biography that Harper wrote, and it's kept at the University of Michigan. It's in one of their libraries. So there were all these documents and a lot of the letters, but many of the letters had been destroyed, which was really unfortunate. But there were many other suffrage letters at the I really made the rounds with, you know, all the libraries and archives and Library of Congress and the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. And they also had a lot of photographs, and that was a lot of fun, too.
Having attended Albion College, does Albion College use her, so to speak, as a famous former student or alumnus?
The most important thing is that our Women's Center is named after Anna Howard Shaw. So, yes, we do use her. I wish all the students knew more about her, and we keep working on that, and I'm hoping this book really helps with that. But Albion was very important for Shaw. It was the place where she got her grounding, that she really knew that she had something that she could use to make a mark on the world. And from Albion, you know, she needed that confidence, because when she went to Boston University Seminary, it was not a good experience.
To what extent were race and class issues in the suffrage movement? It wasn't just whether women can get the right to vote.
Right. And I think that that is something that whenever we look at U.S. history, we always have to take into consideration. When Shaw became president, there were two women, Southern white women, who were on the board who were absolutely opposed to the Federal Amendment, never supported it. And they really blocked a lot of the efforts of the more progressive women to make an emphasis on the Federal Amendment. And Shaw has sometimes gotten some bad press because she forced a turnover on the board. Well, part of the turnover was that, you know, she tried to get rid of these women who were really blocking a universal suffrage. And as sort of an indicator is that in 1903, the National had a segregated conference in New Orleans. But, and then, you know, Shaw took over a year later. By 1912, W.E.B. Du Bois was the keynote speaker at the conference in Philadelphia. So I think that we see that there was a big shift during, and that Shaw doesn't get all the credit for it, but she does get some credit for it. And I think the same thing on the issue of class, you know, that until that time, it only was leisured women or women, privileged women, who could take on the leadership. But with Shaw, in a very interesting arrangement set up by Susan B. Anthony, was able to earn a salary as president of the National. And that meant that she, as a working woman, and several other working women were able to provide leadership. They reached out to working women, along with younger women and men, and I think really broadened the base of the suffrage movement.
So what sorts of things did Anna Howard Shaw do after she left the movement?
Well, after she left the actual office of the presidency, she continued to be part of that, but just not in the same kind of role. She was still traveling and speaking. But then as we got close to World War I, I argued that she was drafted. She was drafted by President Wilson and by members of his cabinet to head what is called the Women's Committee of the Council for National Defense, which coordinated all of the women's efforts during World War I on the domestic scene. And so she, along with Carrie Chapman Catt, Ida Tarbell, and many other women, got together, and they were supposed to work through the incredible networks that women had already by this point to coordinate things like food issues, food rationing, what we would call today recycling, all sorts of things that women were called upon to do to support the war effort. And then at the very end, she was the first woman to receive a Distinguished Service Medal for that effort. She also, in the last few weeks of her life, spoke at the first anti-lynching conference. She was then on the road with former President Taft to try to support the League of Nations.
Congress passed the 19th Amendment in 1919, and Anna Howard Shaw died shortly after that, so she didn't live to see the ratification of the 19th Amendment.
Well, she didn't live to see it, but you know, we had that whole process where states were passing their suffrage amendments, and Shaw had transferred her residency to New York about the time that New York passed women's suffrage. And so at that point, and the New York passage was really the tipping point, because once that great big congressional delegation had women's suffrage on their agenda, then it was going to change. But Shaw probably got to vote in the New York elections, and that included a presidential election.
What a remarkable life.
It was a remarkable life. And really, I think that we need to understand Shaw and the role that she played in that. I think that hopefully a lot of the suffrage and sort of women's history will be reconsidered if we put Shaw back in.
The book is Anna Howard Shaw, The Work of Woman Suffrage, written by Albion College professor Tricia Franzen. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Scott. This was wonderful.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And Tricia Franzen will discuss Anna Howard Shaw's legacy at the Michigan Women's Center and Hall of Fame at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, March 20th. Today is a big day for the Lansing area. March 3rd, 2014 marks the very first day that homeless individuals in the Capital Region will have a medical clinic to call their own. The new $900,000 project, which is located at 430 North Larch Street, is a collaboration between the area's largest healthcare provider, Sparrow Health System, and the region's largest homeless services provider, Volunteers of America, Michigan. Here to tell us more are representatives of these two organizations. Joining us by phone is Patrick Patterson. He's the Executive Vice President for Development at Volunteers of America, Michigan. Welcome, Patrick.
Joe, it's good to be with you.
And Joe Ruth is here in the studio. He's the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Sparrow Health Systems. Welcome.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, congratulations. Today, the clinic sees its first patients. I got to ask, from concept to finally today, how long has this been in the works, Patrick?
Well, it's been about 5 years that we've been working on this. We really got some steam in 2010 when we got the earmark, and then Joe and a bunch of other community leaders jumped in to help us. It's been a wonderful ride.
When you say the earmark, now you're talking about a federal grant or federal money that came through for this.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And how much was that?
It was $389,000.
Yeah. So this kind of came together with that earmark. Were there any doubts along the way, any setbacks? Joe, from your point of view?
It's definitely been quite a journey. They're finding the right kind of people that have the right kind of orientation to put it on the line every day and help folks out is most important. And actually, we found that person in Dr. Lynn Nevin that's going to man the clinic, and she is just a wonderful clinical leader for us.
So she's taken off today. The door's open for patients today. Patrick, tell us about the clinic. How much staff do you have? You know, doctors, nurses. Give us a bit of the nuts and bolts.
Well, this is really Joe's question, because these are all Sparrow staff.
Well, then pitch back over to Joe. Joe, then you tell us. What do you got over there?
Well, we have Dr. Lynn Nevin. We also have a mid-level practitioner and a handful of medical assistants. And we have room to grow. We ultimately believe we might have two physicians plus a mid-level. We have, I believe it's 8 exam rooms. We have a procedure room. And this is really a family practice. We will take all comers, and we will be their medical home. Many of these people obviously wait until there's a crisis in their lives. They show up in our emergency room, which will treat that incident, but never across the longitudinal care that they need. This is going to be home for them. And so they've got a medical home tied into their temporary home that Patrick provides through the VOA, and it's a real powerful model.
Now, just to clarify for folks here, it's open to residents of the VOA shelters, the VOA system. Is that correct, Joe?
It's actually open to anybody in the community that needs care. This is a family practice. It's not by appointment. We understand that many of these folks don't have a routine schedule, and so it is a walk-in family practice clinic, and we're prepared to take as many folks as need care.
In the community as well?
Okay. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Are there certain requirements, income level requirements, or is it a sliding scale fee pay? How does that work?
We're standing at the ready to take care of people regardless of their ability to pay. Certainly on April of this year, there'll be a Medicaid expansion that it probably provides more coverage to people through the state of Michigan than they've had previously. And so certainly if they have insurance, we will accept that. But that's not a precursor to getting in the door.
Mm-hmm. What types of care? You mentioned family practice, so preventative care and that kind of thing. Is there specialized care, psychiatric care, or that type of thing? Or how will that work?
There will always be some psychosocial aspects to almost anybody's care. And this practice will be able to handle that on a certain level. Certainly, if there are specialty referrals, we will refer them elsewhere within the health system to get their needs met. We've talked a lot about this being kind of an experimental thing, that we will grow it over time based on our understanding of the needs of the patients. But there'll be a lot of social work involved. There'll be a lot of support systems involved. And, one other piece, and Patrick, I'll throw this back over to you. I think we're working towards even providing some dental care as a part of this, which is also an underlying health concern of many people.
Yeah, that's right. Excited to get started on that. It's this clinic's not only the right necessary thing to do, but it's also innovative and clever, and we expect to yield a lot of outcomes with it. And that's one of the reasons why we want to add dental, because dentistry, tooth pain is 18% of ER visits, and that's not a purposeful solution. Again, the ER is about safety, and getting something done requires a design practice for it, so we're very excited about that.
Patrick, you say innovative and clever. Expand on that. What do you mean?
Well, Joe gave a great review of what the clinic will be doing, and the reason that we decided to put it at Volunteers of America is we've got 13 existing homeless service programs there. So what we'll be doing is kind of what I call the poor man's interdisciplinary team. So I always say we can't succeed without Sparrow, and Sparrow can't succeed without us for this population, because it's folks need the supportive services that both the medical and the psychosocial support stuff from Sparrow, and then our support programs help folks gain stability and things like employment and housing and things like that. And so that, so you can get a person medically stable, and then if their life is still chaos, that stability isn't going to last. So that's basically what it's about. And there's not a lot of combination outfits in the nation.
Okay, very cool. Can you give us a sense, Patrick, of the need for this, of the need for health care for homeless and very low-income individuals in this region? Has it been steadily getting greater, remained the same? Characterize the need for us.
I can't talk. We know that there's a great need for health care, and that there is increasing access to health care with the changes in the law, and those are all good things. In our population, we have huge levels of disability, and that's what is, the main variable that will keep our folks chronically homeless. And then almost none of the folks that we serve have, regular medical care. So when Joe talks about family practice, that's a strange term. And part of the conversations that we're having with homeless folks is, yeah, you mean I can go to the doctor here at VOA? It's just really basic stuff mm-hmm. that folks are not familiar with. This there's an education and there's an access component here because of our traditional insurance system where folks haven't had access to these lasting, stable medical care systems. And so this is really, it's heartwarming. I love it.
Joe Ruth, Chief Operating Officer of Sparrow Health Systems, no doubt there is a financial component to this. Sparrow Health Systems had to absorb some of this healthcare and this issue. Can you characterize that? You know, what sort of services were you giving to this population that you hoped to kind of offset financially through this?
I would start by saying that, you know, Sparrow is coming up on our 118th anniversary in this community, and being of the community and for the community, this is what we're supposed to do. You know, as a not-for-profit healthcare system, these are the things that we're supposed to do for our community. And so we didn't put the kind of financial discipline and rigor around this particular project that we may with, say, a new cancer center or something like that. This is the right thing to do for the people of Lansing. The visit we made to South Bend, Indiana, that Patrick took us on those 5 years ago, opened our eyes to the fact that we need to do right by the most vulnerable patients or the most vulnerable people in our community. And so we're doing this for all the right reasons. And so certainly there's a significant cost to this clinic. But it's all part of our mission, and it's probably one of the best things that we have done in a long time. Our board of directors, all local business people, all local leaders, didn't blink an eye when we brought this to them. So we've got a great idea, and it was a leap of faith on their part, and I think this is going to pay extraordinary dividends for the entire community for many years to come.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking the time today to discuss this exciting new clinic opening today. It's a conjunction with the Volunteers of America Michigan and Sparrow Health System. Patrick Patterson is Executive Vice President for Development at Volunteers of America, and Joe Ruth is Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Sparrow Health System. Thank you, gentlemen. Good luck.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just come in here on their lunch break and kill time.
I could spend all day here.
And I'll play probably 50 guitars before I walk out here.
There is no place I've ever seen like it, ever.
I mean, there's not another elderly anywhere.
Well, if you strum, pick, or fiddle, chances are you've come across Lansing's elderly instruments. Michigan's home to new, vintage, used guitars, mandolins, ukuleles, violins, stringed instruments of every type. It is a mecca to musicians of all descriptions. Peter Worf is here. Peter is executive producer and station manager here. Peter is here to tell us a little more about Elderly in this documentary. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Joe. As you probably know, the word elderly is sort of like a password among string musicians in Michigan and worldwide.
It really is. Someone new to the community, it took me a very short time to figure out elderly.
That's right. That means elderly instruments, one of Lansing's great treasures, where you can find acoustic guitars, banjos, ukuleles, fiddles, electric guitars, amps of all shapes and sizes. It's all there. The phrase kid in a candy store, you'll hear all the time. You can just go crazy in there as a musician and spend all day for a week and just not see or certainly play everything. And that's one of the beautiful things about elderly is any instrument you can just sort of take down off the wall and play as long as you want. I had the chance to speak with Bob Albers, who's here at MSU, a senior video specialist, and he made the 2012 documentary, Elderly Instruments, All Things Strings, which has just been released now on DVD. And when we spoke, we started off with Bob recalling his early days in Lansing and himself, a guitarist, classical guitarist, looking for a new instrument.
Of course, when I got here, I looked for a music store. And I had a kind of a sort of a not very good guitar. I'd been through a bunch of instruments over my performing and teaching career. And I was looking for a good instrument as well. And so I went there, and I was just totally blown away. Yeah. It's a magical place. And I resonate with it because I was a musician, and I still am a musician. In fact, this morning before I came here, I was working on this little waltz by Antonio Lauro. I play classical guitar. And everybody plays it not like a waltz. And so I got trapped into that too. So I was working on it today, trying to actually put the waltz rhythm into it. So, I mean, that has nothing to do with elderly, except it does really, because I bought the guitar I was playing while I was working on the film at Elderly.
Are these the types of instruments that you could find in, many types of guitar stores that you would walk into, or is it something that might be a little more specialized that you'd find at a place like Elderly?
They have everything.
Yeah.
And they have, almost any kind of instrument that you would want, you could find. The two that I settled on because I did what you're able to do at Elderly, which is I picked up every single one they had on the floor. I played them all. I compared them. Nobody came and asked me what the heck I was doing. And I got thrilled with the sound of both of these instruments at different times.
That's a notion that's made very clear through your documentary, is that anyone can come in and play anything. We see a shot of a $7,500 Gibson guitar, expensive Martin guitars, other instruments. Somebody in the documentary says you would never see one just hanging out there in another store, these types of instruments, just hanging on the wall for you to pick up.
It's true. You might see it hanging on the wall, but it would be up too high for you to reach it.
Tags that 20,000, 10,000, 120,000. Yeah, that's not uncommon for in here. There's 250,000 over there, I know.
So that is one of the great traits of Elderly, is that you can go in there, and they have probably thousands of instruments on the floor. Maybe it's hundreds. I don't know. I never bothered to count it.
Right.
And then another, multiply that by 25 or 50 behind the scenes. But all the ones that are out, you can pick up any one of them at any time. And the ones that are out range from, a couple of $100 to 15,000 or so.
Stan Werben is the owner of Elderly Instruments. He gives us a really fun office tour with everything from a Tiny Tim bobblehead to an ash urn with the label on it, Ashes of Problem Employees.
Yeah.
He's quite a character.
He is. He's a terrific man and a terrific businessman. He's a musician, and I think he thinks of himself primarily as a businessman, but clearly a businessman who loves music.
The concept of that my partner and I had when we first started the store back in 1972, which is that we wanted to have a music store that we would like to come into, that we enjoyed walking through the door, and that where we'd be able to try the instruments, which is not always true at all music stores these days, and it was much less true in those days, that you could actually try instruments off the wall without having somebody hover over you and hand you the instrument and so on.
The first time I went into his office, I thought, oh, this is it. This is where the whole spirit of the store comes from. Because if you look around, there's at first glance, it looks like there's a lot of junk around. And maybe that's true, but it's stuff that fits with the theme of Elderly and the spirit of Elderly, the two things that you mentioned, and instruments in all stages of repair or disrepair, things hanging on the wall that you would never expect to see. It's wonderful. This office is crazy chaotic.
It is, and I loved that box. I had to point this one out because it made me laugh out loud while I was watching the film. The box of what they called tone balls, that sort of flotsam and jetsam that gathers inside the guitar over the years, lint, cigarette ashes. And they had these on display almost like a butterfly collection.
It does look that way. It is behind glass. It hangs on the wall. It's in the place they call the bro counter. And the bro counter is a place where you come and lay your instrument down if you need it worked on. And so hundreds and thousands of people over the years have brought their instruments in to be worked on, and they clean them. Mm-hmm. And when they clean them, if it's worth keeping, they keep it. So you're right.
You guys have seen our tone ball collection? These are all conglomerations of lint and debris that comes out of vintage instruments. And they're all labeled here as to what instrument they came out of. There's some real good ones in there. Like this actually came out of Ted Nugent's guitar, number one. So anyway.
I was kind of blown away by that too when they showed it to us.
I'm talking with Bob Albers, the senior video specialist at Michigan State University's College of Communication Arts and Sciences, producer and director of the documentary Elderly Instruments, All Things Strings, now available, recently available on DVD. We get a great sampling of the music that's typically heard inside of the store every day. Texas swing bands, hot club style, bluegrass music. You're a classical musician. You can buy instruments that are suitable for so many styles of music. And this is also discussed as a contributor to the, I was going to say national, but international reputation of the store. Can you talk about that?
Well, I can give you an example of the international reputation of Elderly. I was in London a few years ago on a documentary, teaching a overseas study class in documentary. And I was walking down the street and I saw this guitar, a picture of a guitar up on a sign. And I thought, man, I should go into that. And it turned out, it was called Ivor Morant's Guitar Store. And it was not an Elderly Instruments store, because all the instruments, which were very expensive, were behind glass. But I went in there and I got to talking to the clerk. I wanted to try an instrument. And he said, what do you do? I said, well, I was a musician, but now I make documentary films. And he said, what are you working on now? And I said, I'm working on a film about a music store in Lansing, Michigan. And he goes, Elderly Instruments. Yeah. So here's a guy in London in a guitar store. He knows it. And I think people all over the world do. I mean, in the documentary, we have two guys from Czechoslovakia who can barely say Elderly, but they know it, and they went, and they came specifically to Elderly because Elderly has wonderful mandolins. The fellow was a mandolin maker. The two guys were a mandolin maker and his buddy, who one of them played well and one of them made them. And so they were there to see the wonderful instruments that Elderly had. So people know about it all over the world.
Český republiky, from Czech Republic.
Yeah, it's greatest. I can say it's greatest, but I can't say Elderly.
I really enjoyed some of the bands that I mentioned before, the many different styles. One was called the Rhythm Club, a duo of that sort of gypsy hot club style of guitar, and not violin like the great Stefan Grappelli, but cello, which was kind of a wonderful flavor, and a singer as well. Can you tell me about the Rhythm Club?
The leader of the Rhythm Club is Rob Bourassa, who's a fantastic guitar player, and I apologize, I can't think of the names of the other two players. It's a cellist, a real sort of hippie-looking cellist with great facial expressions. I mean, their music is wonderful, but also seeing them is wonderful.
That's right.
And then a delightful young female singer.
Wonderful style. I never get enough of that wonderful style. Yeah.
We met Rob first because he was doing a workshop, and then talked to him about, and we have that workshop in the film as well, but we talked to him about would he be willing to perform, and he said, yeah, we're coming back down there. So he did and brought his friends. And they are just wonderful, just terrific musicians. We've on message boards around the country, once the film was broadcast, people have reacted to that group in particular, because I think they really are virtuosic and special.
Bob, you're the producer and director and writer of this documentary, All Things Strings. But as we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, you're also a guitarist, a musician. What was the greatest joy for you about making the film as a musician at Elderly Instruments?
Any time that I am around really good musicians, that's a thrill, an absolute thrill. And over my career, I've really been blessed. I've worked with Itzhak Perlman and Isaac Stern and Janos Starker, Wynton Marsalis, the Juilliard String Quartet, the Beaux-Arts Trio. And, you know, those are, I mean, I'm a musician, but I'm not really a musician, not like those people are. So getting to be around those kinds of people is very special. Now probably the people that we meet in that film about elderly are not quite at the level of those people, but they're very, very good musicians, and that was a thrill.
Bob Albers is senior video specialist at Michigan State University's College of Communication Arts and Sciences, director and producer of Elderly Instruments, All Things Strings. That's now available at Elderly Instruments' website at elderly.com. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Peter. It was fun.
For Current State, I'm Peter Whorf.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, Mark Bayshore will return, and I'll return to my rightful place behind the glass. And we'll explore how foreign aid impacts emerging democracies and discuss what it's like being a female in the construction industry. That and more, Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Whorf. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, and also Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Joe Lindstroth. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.